for it to work economically, the Russians would have had to pay us to take it. At the time, a few million dollars or so.
An economist takes a hard look at the wisdom of the Alaska Purchase. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 10th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the modest beginnings of a master grass weaver.
We had to go down to the lagoon to pick grass with my mom, and boy, did we hate it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. People are either sighted or blind, right? Wrong. Many eye conditions can lead to low vision. People with low vision have some sight, but even with glasses, they may still have trouble doing things they're used to. A low vision assessment helps people identify special tools and skills to live on their own independently and succeed at work. Learn more at 248-7770 or alaskabvi.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired with support from Lions Clubs.
Governor Sean Parnell came to a blizzard-struck Nome today to announce his choice for Western Alaska's vacant House District 39 seat. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has more.
The Democratic Party Selection Committee gave Parnell three choices, Sam Tawarik and Weaver Ivanoff from Unalakleet, as well as Neil Foster of Nome. The governor revealed his decision at a public gathering in Nome's historic Pioneer Igloo No. 1.
And I found all three to be qualified for the position, and it's my job to select one to be the new representative of this region. And today I wanted to announce that I am selecting Neil Foster to be the new representative. So congratulations, Neil, and congratulations to the entire region.
The 37-year-old Foster is the eldest son of Richard Foster, an 11-term House veteran who died last month. The elder Foster's health had been in decline for the past few years. He needed a kidney transplant, but complications including a stroke and blood infection prevented that from happening. He died from a heart attack on October 13th at the age of 63. Parnell said the younger Foster possesses qualities that will serve his district well.
I found him to have a statewide vision and perspective as well, so he will look out for you as his constituents along with the rest of the state in doing so. I appreciate his integrity, I appreciate his engagement, the way he engages in local issues and the way he engages with people. I think that he will bring about that new energy and that new vision and that concern for the region and the people of this area.
Foster is a member of the Nome City Council and also sits on the board of directors for the area's Sitnisok Native Corporation. Foster says he's eager to help advance the governor's agenda on behalf of rural Alaska.
I look forward to working with his administration. There are a number of initiatives that he's very passionate about. One of them is responsible resource development and to get jobs in rural Alaska, and that's very important. The other thing is providing scholarships for our students who want to attend school within the state, and then also the VPSO program. It's a very important program to make sure that we've got public safety as strong within the villages.
Foster needs a simple majority of House Democrats to win confirmation to the District 39 seat. The district encompasses dozens of communities on the West Coast from Wales to Chivac. In Nome, I'm Lorelei Kanin.
When the U.S. bought Alaska from the Russians in 1867, it may have been known as Seward's Folly, but conventional wisdom is that Alaska has proven that initial notion wrong, and that the state's great natural resource wealth has paid for the $7.2 million purchase price many times over. But Professor David Barker says folly may not be such a bad description, at least when you consider the pure economics of the transaction. Barker is an economics professor at the University of Iowa, and he has a new paper out called Was the Alaska Purchase a Good Deal? Barker says he assumed the answer would be yes when he started researching the paper as a fun way to teach his students about real estate.
A while back, I thought that the Alaska Purchase might be a good example to use in class of the best real estate deal ever in history. But the more I looked into it, the more I thought, well, maybe it wasn't such a good deal financially after all. So I spent some time looking up every appropriation ever made for Alaska and all of the tax revenue coming in, and did some financial calculations and found on just a purely financial basis, it doesn't seem to have been a good investment.
And how did you come to that conclusion that Alaska hasn't been worth the cost?
Right. Well, when I looked at tax revenue, and the idea was that a lot of the benefits of Alaska, trade and things like that, could have been obtained without the purchase. The only thing that really changed historically because the United States bought Alaska was that we were able to tax economic activity in Alaska. And so I calculated, just what's the return to the taxpayers? The taxpayers spent the money to buy Alaska, and on the enormous expenditures involved in governing Alaska over all those years, and then, received in return tax revenue, income tax revenue, money from land sales, royalties on minerals, and in particular on oil.
And so do you think the purchase would have penciled out at any price?
The price would have had to have been negative. So for it to work economically, the Russians would have had to pay us to take it. Wouldn't have been, a few at the time, a few million dollars or so.
And what about non-economic reasons? Do you consider any of those for Alaska maybe have being a good deal?
Well, that's important, and I think that's one of the things that got me interested in the topic, is that if the purchase wasn't for economic reasons, if it didn't make sense economically, well, then maybe other reasons were the real reason for the purchase. Or if we have this idea that the Alaska Purchase was a good idea, well, then it's if it's not economics, it must be those other things, like the possible military value of the strategic location of Alaska. And I thought about that and talked about that some. I think that's a difficult question, but I think there's some reasons to think that the military value is maybe less than people often assume. Territorial acquisitions are always justified by military necessity. The United States always said that, having Cuba, when the United States controlled Cuba, was, a vital national importance. At one time, people thought that it was important that we control all of Canada. But we've managed to, even though people thought they were strategic necessities, we've managed to get along without them.
Well, what about the scenery and wildlife here?
Well, that's all wonderful stuff, but they don't necessarily justify a purchase. I mean, if they did, then there are lots of other areas of the world that we ought to go out and try and take over or purchase.
And Mr. Barker, have you been to Alaska yourself?
I have not. It's the only state in the country I haven't been to.
And have you considered with this paper that you might not be the most popular person in Alaska?
Well, the results really don't reflect badly on Alaska. And like I said, if the economics didn't make sense, then it must be other qualities of Alaska, other things, maybe simple pride of ownership. Maybe people simply wanted to control Alaska because there's so many wonderful things about the state. So finding out that it's not economically beneficial, or for taxpayers anyway, I think highlights those other qualities. The story came out in an Alaska newspaper a few days ago, and it initially generated many hostile comments. And after about 150 or so, I jumped in and started defending myself. And very quickly, the tone of the conversation changed, and I got very thoughtful, very reasonable comments from people. Some of which, I think I'll use to help improve the research. So, I don't know. I hope it's not taken that way.
David Barker is an economics professor at the University of Iowa. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the effort to save a unique and historic ferry.
The beauty of the Kalakala is its community. What it gave to the world at the time of the Depression was all about giving to people.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Grass basket weaving is an ancient and fine art that many Alaska Native women continue today. Variations in the types of baskets can vary with the region and the Native people engaging in the art. The woven grass sock artwork of Inupiaq and Aleut weaver June Pardue is a study in beauty, function, and recapturing a practical way of keeping your feet dry. As part of our continuing series on Native education in South Central Alaska, I went to the Alaska Heritage Museum in Midtown Anchorage to watch her weaving traditional Aleut grass socks. Pardue's interest in weaving goes back more than 40 years when she grew up in Old Harbor.
And when my mother was learning from Aleutic weavers, I was picking scraps up off the floor and trying to weave.
Her mother was Inupiaq, and she says although she doesn't remember Aleut people using grass socks, she remembers her Inupiaq aunties putting grass in her boots to keep them dry when they were out playing in the cold.
Or sometimes even helping Grandpa gather ice blocks for water. We'd get home and our aunties and my mom would take the grass inserts out of our boots to dry.
She says growing up in Old Harbor, before she herself became a weaver, she had to help the women who were already skilled at the art.
We had to go down to the lagoon to pick grass with my mom, and boy, did we hate it. Just because it was a chore.
Now she collects beach grass from Kodiak Island in July, her favorite month, to harvest it.
Brought it back up to Sutton, where I live, and while it was green, wove it into like long skirts and hung it outside so that the sun could bleach it. And if we thought it was going to be raining, we'd roll it up, take it off the wall, roll it up and bring it indoors and put it in a cool dark room. And bringing it out daily, every time the sun was shining, we'd bring it out to have it sun cured, sun bleached.
On this day, a few interested people hover intently, watching her twist, twine, and weave thin blades of beach grass into the leggings that are climbing from the soles of her tightly woven grass socks. This is a demonstration, but Pardue has for years taught weaving around the state. She lives in Sutton now, but for a time in the 80s lived in Homer and was hired to go to villages to teach the art.
While I was in Port Graham, we revived the art of Aleutic weaving down there. It had been lost. No one was weaving. So I took the women and the girls down to the beaches during the summer months, and we picked, you know, grass for their projects.
She says she's happy that they kept at it.
And now they have weavers who continue to make baskets, you know, and that is really, really what touches me inside, is knowing that people are still weaving. Are now weaving in that area, and also in Sand Point. I took a trip out to Sand Point through the artist in residency program through the Alaska State Council on the Arts, and I understand that there's a lady down there who's now weaving real fine baskets, and that's rewarding for me.
She says she's had men in classes who became great weavers and people who had never before touched a blade of grass but were able to pick it up quickly. One of her baskets sat nearby as she worked on the grass socks. The tiny, tight weave and intricate pattern would seem an impossible task for anyone with large hands. But Pardue says an elder in Old Harbor who was known for her fine work defied that idea.
You know, I get some people who comment and say, I can't weave, I've got such big hands. Well, she had football hands. Her hands were huge, but that lady could weave.
She says weaving is a good, quiet time for elders to pass on information to young people, things they need to know as they grow into adults. She says she thinks about this with her own 8 grandchildren.
4 granddaughters who need to be sitting down and weaving and the valuable time that it would create just for us to have together, you know, and maybe for me to share some intimate things in life with them, so that it doesn't sound like I'm coming across lecturing. So values can be intertwined with weaving.
June Pardue will be back at the Wells Fargo Alaska Heritage Museum on Tuesday, November 24th, continuing work on the Aleut grass socks. Pictures are at our website, aprn.org. A clean energy consultant believes a groundbreaking heating system in Seward using seawater may have applications in Sitka and other coastal communities. Anchorage-based engineer Andy Baker has been assisting the Seward Sea Life Center to design and install the seawater system, which uses a heat exchanger in conjunction with a fairly conventional heat pump system to extract BTUs from the chilly waters of Resurrection Bay. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Baker was in Sitka to discuss the Seward project with local officials and to make a presentation to the Chamber of Commerce. The Seward Sea Life Center's system was jump-started with $430,000 in federal Denali Commission funding for emerging technology. Baker told the Chamber that there were similarities between Resurrection Bay and Sitka Sound that suggested exchanging heat from seawater would work here.
If you have a fjord or a bay that's facing mostly south, and doesn't have a big tidal sweep, in other words, the current is not exchanging all the water quickly all the time, you'll get a tremendous amount of solar gain in that bay. And if you look at Resurrection Bay, it's facing south, so the sun bakes it all summer long. That solar energy penetrates deep in the water, and that water holds on to that heat. It's like a solar bathtub.
The coolant in a heat pump is warmed by contact with the air, the ground, or seawater, and those BTUs are pumped into a heating system. Baker says that depending on the size of the heat source and the capacity of the coolant loop, it's possible for a heat pump to produce hot water temperatures between 120 and 130 degrees, which is lower than conventional baseboard or steam heat, but adequate for modern in-floor heating systems. Baker told the Chamber that seawater heat pumps sound like magic, but they're only viable under the right conditions.
What the seawater heat pumps essentially allow you to do is to borrow about two-thirds of the total heat from the ocean. So you're putting in one-third electric heat, but you're getting the other two-thirds from the ocean. So if you had a building like your city hall, it's all electric heat, I understand. If you were to shift that to seawater heat pumps, your heating demand, your electric demand to heat that building would drop to one-third of what it is now.
Seawater systems, like anything in contact with salt water, are not maintenance-free. Baker said the Sea Life Center was tapping into its existing saltwater pump system for its aquariums. The intakes for the system are at a depth of 300 feet and can't be serviced by divers in regular scuba gear. For other coastal projects, Baker is recommending intakes at a depth of about 60 feet. The water leaves the Seward system about 4 degrees cooler than it entered, and it is pumped through the aquariums, where the animals are said to prefer the slightly colder temperatures. Baker told the Sitka Chamber that this was an irony of seawater systems he's worked on so far. They did not produce any CO2 emissions, and they actually cooled ocean water.
Climate change is caused by trapping greenhouse gas partially. That heat's going into the ocean. So we've heated up our oceans a bit, apparently. Well, why not go and pull some heat out of the ocean and not burn fossil fuels? So the problem may also be the solution.
Baker warned that seawater heat systems were capital intensive, but if you looked far enough into the future, you might find viability. Baker is from Anchorage. His firm is called Your Clean Energy Consulting. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska, delivering jobs and revenues to Alaska for 20 years and now working on the next 20 years. Online at reddogalaska.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The former Washington State ferry Calacala, currently tied up in Tacoma, Washington, may have a new home soon. KMXT's Jay Barrett has more on the future of this historic ship, which spent nearly half its life as a cannery in Alaska.
The current owner of the Calacala, Steve Rodriguez, would like to restore the 276-foot ship to its 1935 Art Deco glory and make it a centerpiece on the waterfront of Port Angeles on Washington's Olympic Peninsula. But, he adds, there are other possible homes for the unique ship.
We have basically three sites that we have really, truly, effortlessly tried to gain some level of participation on. Of course, Coleman Dock, Pier 48 in Seattle will always be, you know, on the radar for the Calacala. Tacoma, there's a private piece of property there. And, of course, the city of Port Angeles is where it served, from Port Angeles to Victoria.
After retirement from ferry service, the Calacala spent nearly 30 years beached in Kodiak's Gibson Cove, serving as a fish processing plant. It was refloated and towed to Seattle in 1998 by Peter Beavis, who bought it from the city of Kodiak. The price tag to restore the Calacala is now estimated to be $11 million, a figure which has skyrocketed in recent years. But despite the number of dot-com billionaires in Washington State, Rodriguez says money is not what the Calacala needs most.
Why haven't Paul Allen stepped to the plate, or Bill and Melinda Gates? Those people give in their own way, and it's not the sense of needing $1 billion or a billionaire. It's the sense of needing a community, and that's immeasurable value. And it doesn't take $11 million. I could have done it for three. Prices of materials and just inflation have caused it to impact an increase in cost to $11.2 million. Now, that's just to get it beautiful.
One plan Rodriguez has for the ship is to replace its hull. The original hull came from a San Francisco Bay ferry called the Peralta, which burned to the waterline in 1933, upon which the Calacala's unique streamlined superstructure was built. He said the Peralta's hull could be put on display while the Calacala sails on a new one. With as many goals for the ship, it's obvious Rodriguez has a passion for the Calacala beyond it being a simple investment.
The beauty of the Calacala is its community. What it gave to the world at the time of the Depression was all about giving to people, and it's about community. And Kodiak is a part of the community of the Calacala. It's not about restoring the ship. The truth is, the Calacala is beautiful from its story. And the truth is, history is facts. And our biggest accomplishment has been over the past years since left Kodiak is bringing it back to a sense of community and restoring the sense of community before we restore the ship. They should have never have disgraced it, nor shamed it, nor retired it. They should have honored it. They should have respected its history. It truly gave so much to so many, and it was abused.
Rodriguez says once the Calacala is seaworthy again, he'd like to sail it back to Kodiak for a visit. In the meantime, he's awaiting word on a $700,000 National Park Service Save America's Treasures grant to begin work on the ship. The Calacala was added to the National Registry of Historic Places in 2006. I'm Jay Barrett.
Marathon paddlers are starting to think about next summer's Yukon River Quest. Registration opened earlier this month for the 12th annual Wilderness Race, which runs from Whitehorse to Dawson City. Organizers say it's the world's longest yearly canoe and kayak marathon. From Ember Station KHNS, Tara Bicknell reports.
Skagway's Jeff Brady has paddled the race a few times before. He actually helped start the quest in 1998 and still sits on the board of directors. He says the prize money for the race is up this year to $36,500 total. That includes a new $500 cash prize to the top First Nations team to finish.
We've been able to beef up the prize money over the past few years, just mainly because of interest. And we actually peaked at the limit of 100 teams 2 years ago. It dropped a bit last year. I think the economy had something to do with that. But we're hoping for it to get back up to 2008 numbers this year.
Although the race itself doesn't actually start until June 30th, November 1st is an important date to the quest. Not only is registration now open, but Brady says this is a good time to start training, too.
As somebody who's done it a couple of times, you got to really train for it. and get yourself ready for it. And that starts right now, getting in the gym right now, and then getting on the water as soon as you can in the spring.
In the Yukon River Quest, paddlers have 60 hours to travel through 460 miles of wilderness Yukon River from Whitehorse to Dawson City. The chase has sportsmen racing around the clock beneath bright summer skies with two mandatory rest stops along the way.
So a lot of times it's just a matter of survival. I know the top men's canoe team last year was not particularly fast, but two of the top teams got injured or got sick, and they had to drop out, and then all of a sudden a slower team was able to manage to sneak up. For a lot of people, it's just finishing is, and I'd say for the majority of paddlers, just finishing the race is winning. I mean, it's hard. It's the hardest thing you ever do.
Participants from 9 different countries were part of last year's race, and this year's roster already includes one of the top kayakers in the world and some international Olympians. But Brady hopes that more locals will be part of the 2010 quest.
But, you know, we're still hoping for a lot of interest from Alaskans, and we usually have a Skagway team every year, and once in a while somebody from Haines will jump in, so we're hoping to get good Southeast Alaska representation.
Registration must be in by April 15th, 2010. Registration forms, fees, and rules are posted at yukonriverquest.com.
It's not a camping trip down the river by any means. If you want to go explore the Yukon River, take your time and do it over 10 to 15 days. But if you want to race it and try and be part of something pretty dynamic, you know, there's usually between 180 and 240 paddlers on the river at the same time. So it's a kind of dynamic community trying to get there in 4 days. And that's something pretty special when you get to the end and you're part of that group.
In Haines, I'm Tara Bicknell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, and Tara Bicknell in Haines. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. People are either sighted or blind, right? Wrong. Many eye conditions can lead to low vision, and people with low vision have some sight, but even with glasses, they may still have trouble doing things they're used to. A low vision assessment helps people identify special tools and skills to live on their own independently and succeed at work. Learn more at 248-7770 or alaskabvi.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired, with support from Lions Clubs.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.